Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is February 4th, 2019, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is No Retreat, Baby, No Surrender, Thrombolysis for Acute Ischemic Stroke. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Jerome Hoffman. He is a professor emeritus of medicine and emergency medicine, University of California, Los Angeles, and legend of emergency medicine. Your mantra of don't just do something, stand there, echoes in my head every shift. Welcome back to the SGEM, Jerry.
Hi, Ken.
Well, you have been a voice of reason for decades and taught a generation of physicians critical appraisal skills. And this has been through various peer-reviewed publications, doing emergency medicine abstracts, audio program with Dr. Rick Bucata, another legend of emergency medicine, teaching at the emergency medicine and acute care course, among other things. There was a recent controversy, though, on Twitter the other day, and I wanted to reach out to you and see if you could join the conversation.
Happy to do so.
Well, the website, thennt.com, has been a good resource to find unbiased critical reviews of the literature. So I was wondering, just in general, before we get into this, what were your thoughts about the NNT website to begin with?
So I don't pretend to follow such things very carefully, and I don't read any websites regularly, except for yours, of course.
Well, thank you.
Which one is yours again? No, seriously, when it was, you know, what is NNT? So NNT is number needed to treat. Really shouldn't be a single concept. It should be number needed to treat to benefit, number needed to treat to harm. It has equivalence with number needed to screen or number needed to vaccinate. It's not only treating. But it's the concept is when you're talking about comparing two different interventions, whether it's diagnostic or therapeutic or whatever, how many people would you have to do the intervention for one person to benefit and at the same time, how many for one person to be harmed because of adverse effects, cost, or whatever. This is a really good way to compare interventions. And where it got prominence, probably started to be talked about probably 25, 30 years ago in the medical literature, was there was a famous article, a wonderful article, where they took a bunch of epidemiology fellows and they asked them about what turned out to be the effects of statins, but they didn't tell them it was about statins. Maybe they did. I don't remember the details. But what they did was they presented the correct information in three different ways. One was a 25% or a 20% decrease in mortality and major coronary events. 20% decrease. How important do you think that is? And of course, the respondents all thought it was very, very important. They asked them, what about if you had an intervention that would decrease mortality from 2% to 1.6%, which of course is a 20% relative decrease in mortality. But they didn't say that. They just said people said, well, 2 to 1.6%, it's not unimportant, but it's not terribly important. And they said, what about an intervention where you'd have to give it to 250 people for one to benefit, which is what a 0.4% decrease in mortality is. And they all said, well, that's obviously not very important. It's trivial. It doesn't matter at all. 20% versus an NNT of 250. The importance of this was that NNT, the concept of NNT, allows you to think much more clearly about numbers, about certain types of numbers. The most distorted way to think about comparisons is relative changes. Absolute changes is better, but for an individual, if I want to decide, do I want to take a medicine, for example, it's much more clear to me if it's presented in terms like NNT. You mean 250 people have to take it and only one would benefit? You mean more than 99% of the people who take it would get no personal benefit? Less than half of 1% would get personal benefit? That's a very different way than if you said to me, well, you know, you could die of heart disease, it's a really bad thing, and you have a 20% decrease. That sounds pretty darn good. I don't realize that the vast majority of people who get it won't benefit.
And it doesn't even begin to address harm.
Yes, and that doesn't even begin. NNT is a really good way to also be able to talk about harms. Now, it's not a one-to-one comparison because the harm might not be as important as the benefit. But still, it gives you a much better idea. And it is sort of interesting because years ago, I've often talked about the way that language matters and the way we express things shows us our biases. So we often, I often hear people talk about a risk-benefit relationship or risk-benefit ratio, and the two are not equivalent. Risk is the possibility of harm. Benefit is benefit. It should be a harm-benefit relationship. And what when you look at NNT, it makes you realize how ridiculous it is, because when we talk about risk-benefit, we're acting as though the harm is potential. There's a chance of harm. The benefit is absolute. If the benefit is less than 1 in 100 people, you might say it's a harm versus obscure, minimal chance of benefit. So in any case, NNT is a tool that allows us to think about numbers better. But when it was first proposed, as much as I love the concept of NNT, when the website was first proposed, I said, you know, I'm a little worried about this. I talked with many people about it, because when you start putting numbers, and especially fancy numbers like NNT, on information, it makes the information sound much more objective. And it sounds like, well, now we know, down to 4 decimal points, the truth. But it's only as good as the information upon which you're basing it. So I was very concerned, much so I thought the people who were doing that website were very smart people and had the best intentions in mind. I was very concerned that it might run into the same trap that a lot of, unfortunately, what I see people calling EBM runs into, evidence-based medicine, where it becomes this sort of religious, mathematical belief system rather than what it really should be, which is a way to help us think better. And so the devil's in the details, and it's not only bad enough to make claims based on bad information in general, but you make it even worse when you make the claims sound super objective and fancy with such terms as NNT.
Well, they updated their page recently on thrombolytics for acute ischemic stroke, and they changed the recommendation from red, which is no benefit, to green. They give it a green light. Benefits are greater than the harms. And this was very disturbing on multiple levels. What do you think of this?
Well, you know what I think of it. I'm pretty sure a lot of people know what I think about the use of thrombolytic therapy in stroke. But before we get to that specific question, just the green light, red light thing is a little bit crazy, isn't it? We're in an era now where we're supposed to be talking about shared decision-making with patients. What is that SDM about? It's about the notion that a lot of what we decide is not black and white. It's not it's good or it's bad, but there might be benefits, there might be harms, and depending upon patient values and what they're concerned about, that's how you help them make a decision. That's even if there is a clear benefit to go along with a clear harm. In the case of a stroke, I don't want to go through, I've already, over 25 years, spent a lot of time going through every one of the papers and all the summaries about it, so I'm not enthusiastic about rehashing every one of the details, but when NINS was first published in 1995, December 95, the National Institute of Neurologic Disease and Stroke trial, which was the most important so-called positive trial for thrombolytics for stroke, when it was first published, I expressed concern. At the same time, there were 4 other trials that had been published around that same time, and the other 4 were all negative. And why was everybody believing the positive trial, not the negative trial? For many years after that, my position was, I'm skeptical. I don't think this works, but I don't think there's enough information. And what we need to do is to do another trial using the exact same terms as NINS to see if this really does provide any benefit. And then we can compare it to the harms and see whether or not it's worth it. I was often told that it would be unethical to do another trial because we've already proven it works with NINS. But I think it's exactly got it wrong. So let me back up 1 second. When NINS was done, there were 4 other trials that were negative. There was 1 that was positive. And so the people who said, believe NINS, said, you can't believe those other trials because they obviously don't work. Those are the circumstances in which this doesn't work. But if you do it right, like NINS, that will work. And in trying to explain to people why that's faulty reasoning, I often use the following metaphor. Imagine if I had a coin, a penny, and I said, you know, this is a great penny for getting heads. When I flip it, I always get heads. Let me show you. And I flipped it 10 times. I got 5 heads and 5 tails. I said, wait, no, let me do it again. And I flipped it again. And I got 4 heads and 6 tails. And I flipped it a bunch of times. I kept getting mixed results. And then on the 5th time, I got 7 heads. I said, see, it's a really good heads coin. I got seven heads. He would say to me, wait a second, you just keep flipping it by chance. Once in a while, you're going to get good results. So if I was smart, I wouldn't do that. What I would do instead is I'd line up a whole bunch of pennies. I'd flip the first one and get four heads, and the second one, five heads. And then on the X number of coins, I'd get nine heads, and I'd say, ha-ha, this is the great heads penny. If you were smart, you'd say the same thing to me. Wait a second. You just flipped a whole bunch of coins. It might be that that's a good heads penny, but it might be chance alone. You flip a bunch of times, you're going to get one. So if you want to tell me that that's a good heads penny, flip it again. And if it works again, then I'll believe you. So that's what I kept saying. Flip the men's penny again. And if it works again, it's unethical to pretend to give a treatment that could cause death, which this can, without having really good evidence that it works. So I was skeptical at the beginning. Now, unfortunately, it's never been flipped again. They did, by the way, those people who said it was unethical to keep flipping the NINS penny because they'd already proven it, kept flipping the other pennies, the five-hour pennies, even though they'd already proven it was harmful. How is that ethical? In any case, over the years, my stance has changed. Whereas early I said, it might be a good penny. That might be right, but I'm not sure. I'm skeptical. We need more information. Over the years, we've gotten more and more and more information. And although they haven't done NINS again, there's so much information now, both from the use in the community, from all these other trials, and even from our reanalysis of NINS when we were able to get the raw data from NINS, that makes it clear to me, my personal belief about this today in 2019 is that it is almost certain that this is not a useful intervention. I think since we don't have perfect information, I can't say for sure, but I would say the likelihood is that it does a little more harm than good in perfect, wonderful trials. Outside of trials, it probably does a substantial amount more harm than good. I think there's a chance that in trials, under perfect circumstances, it does neutral, not more harm than good. Maybe even a minuscule amount of benefit, although I think that's very unlikely. The chance that it would do a lot of benefit, that it's important, I think has really come down to close to zero now. There's essentially no chance that this is an important, useful information. I think maybe it's neutral, probably a little harmful, maybe a fairly harmful, unlikely to be dramatically terrible. It's somewhere in there. Probably the best bet, my best point estimate, based on all the information we have, is a little bit harmful. And in the community, fairly substantially harmful. I can't say for sure, but that's how I would read all of the evidence put together.
Well, we've covered the issue of thrombolytics for acute ischemic stroke a number of times on the SJAM, and I'm glad that you didn't want to sort of rehash every single trial. If you want to have a listen, we did that classic NINS paper with Anand Swaminathan, and you can go back and listen to that. But one trial that I did want to talk about was the IST3 trial, because that got a lot of attention, and we did cover it back on the SJAM, but can you comment on that one trial, please?
Sure. I actually wrote an editorial about that with the wonderful Rochelle Cooper. We were astounded at the claims being made from IST3. Just by way of context, IST3 had more patients in it than all the other trials put together, or about as many patients as all the others. It's a huge trial. So it certainly should get a lot of attention. And they proposed to give thrombolytics or not, and then look at results using a standard measure of modified Rankine scales. The conclusion was that they were unable to find benefit. So that was what they found. There are a few things that were much more interesting than that. One was that after they failed to find benefit with the measure they said they were going to use, they said, well, you know what, we use a different measure. And with this different measure, which is stage shift, we did find benefit. I always think that's a little bit like throwing a dart at the dartboard, and you miss the dartboard entirely, hit the wall. Then you say, oh, wait a second, you move the dartboard to where the dart is, and you say, see, I hit it. It's particularly bizarre to do that when the place you move the dartboard to, the place spot on the wall you hit, has previously been mentioned that this is a terrible measure that no one should ever use. When NINS was first done, they explicitly excluded stage shift because they said it's a useless, non-reliable measure. In print, they said that. The advocates for TPA. So here they threw it at the dartboard. They missed. They got a part of the wall that had previously everybody said, you should never go, don't go near that part of the wall. And they said, well, but if we put the dartboard there, see, we got a perfect hit. That gives you an idea of the bias of the authors in trying to do this. Their primary outcome measure, the one that they said they were going to do, failed. Yet they said, give it to everybody. That was their conclusion. Oh, there was one other interesting thing about this. There were something like 6,000 some hundred patients in the study.
Just a slight clarification. The original IST3 power calculation was for 6,000 patients to be enrolled. They changed to an ordinal analysis and then dropped that number down to just over 3,000 patients.
What they did use as their primary outcome measure was the modified Rankin scale. Well, the MRS...
They use the Oxford Handicap Scale.
They're very similar. In any case, for both of these scales, previous studies have shown that when you take two neurologists and you have them evaluate the same patient in person, they disagree with each other frequently about which score to give them. Some give a 1, some give a 2, sometimes even 2 levels off. So it's far from these are far from precise scales, which is why the stage shift is totally ridiculous. But even with that, it makes you realize that even in person, looking at the patient, neurologists don't agree. And this is really important because if a 2 is terrible and a 1 is great, or whatever the particular numbers are, and yet neurologists are all over the place in their estimation, it should give you a lot of pause about believing it. And by the way, if you give the same neurologist, the same patient, and he evaluates him twice without knowing that it's the same patient, he also will disagree with himself not infrequently. So this is not a perfect measurement by any stretch of the imagination. That's done in person, blinded. That wasn't how it was done in the IST3. It was done by in-person evaluation or phone call or lettergram. I don't know what it actually means by a lettergram. They also don't say, who is the person who answered the lettergram? Was there any attempt to verify the results, to say who did it? It usually wasn't the patient, it was somebody else. Who was it? We have no idea. There are other major problems in the study, but just let's fixate on that one. Imagine if you're trying, if you know whether, and by the way, these were with people who knew what treatment they got. So imagine if you said, you called up and you said, you know, Grandpa got that thrombolytic therapy. I know he had a bad stroke, but at least we gave him the good drug. How's he doing? Is he any better? Or you say, you know, I know Grandpa was in our therapy and, unfortunately, he was randomized to we didn't do anything for him. Is he any better? This is crazy. And just to give you an idea of how crazy, and even with that, they found no difference. But to give you an idea of how crazy it is, the first 200 some odd patients, I think it was 270, something like that, in the study weren't done that way. They were evaluated in the hospital by a neurologist, face-to-face, double-blind. And every single outcome they could measure in those 300, which is just almost as many as the whole NINS trial, half as many as the whole NINS trial, in that every outcome was far worse in the group that got thrombolytics when it was double-blind and in person. And yet, so they decided for some reason not to keep doing that, and then did it unblinded by lettergram. And still couldn't find a benefit and still concluded that it was good. This is stunning. This is the opposite of science. And then if you take their results, which overwhelm the results of all the other trials, and you throw it into a mix of a, quote, meta-analysis, without saying, wait a second, that isn't what it claims to be, then of course you're going to get the wrong answer.
And that's exactly... brings us to the Emberson et al. Paper. And this was the reference from 2014 that the NNT updated their recommendation on. That study in The Lancet included the extremely flawed study, the ISD3. It included that out of the 6,700 patients, almost half of them were from the study that you just talked about.
Right. And so that's crazy. We've talked in the past, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but even NINDS, which is by far the most positive of all the trials, and the one on which this is all based, when we went under a FOIA Act, Freedom of Information Act, managed to get all the raw data, and we reevaluated it and added in where you started from, we found no difference in the change in neurologic function in the patients who got it and didn't get it. We found no difference in the early patients versus the late patients, in the placebo group, it didn't matter which thing you got, they all looked exactly the same. In fact, it was scary how if you draw a graph of the outcomes, they look identical. They're overlapping virtually completely. And that's the most positive trial. But even if you believe, this is just beyond that people are going to include terrible, distorted data and measure it in decimal points. And I will mention that in this thing that they wrote, they said, they acknowledged a caveat in the NNT paper. They said skepticism has been mainly in EM literature. However, the discussions of the strengths and limitations of the original trials is beyond the scope of this evidence-based study. Now, that's a non sequitur. It's not an evidence-based study if you don't consider the strengths and limitations of the original study. That is a perversion of the whole concept of evidence.
One of the authors of the report was Dr. Eddie Lang, and Eddie's a friend of mine, and he currently serves as the academic and clinical department head and an associate professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Calgary. And Eddie engaged in some of the tweets that took place recently, and one of the tweets he put up was, "The evidence speaks for itself." But I have a little bit of a problem with that, because I don't think it speaks for itself. Because if it does, it's saying one thing to him. It's saying yes to him for thrombolytics and stroke. And I'm hearing a different voice. I'm hearing a no. And so I would suggest that we need to speak for the results by critically appraising the literature and looking at it and seeing whether they've demonstrated efficacy.
What about if I said to you, I've done a study which looks at horse manure. If you put horse manure in your room every night before you go to bed, I have a study which proves that it cures all cancers. And I published the study, and I published it down to decimal points with 7,000 volunteers and subjects. And then in the caveats at the bottom, I say, the only thing is that I made up the results. Would you say the evidence speaks for itself? Well, there are some limitations to the study, but the evidence speaks. This is craziness. Evidence is only as good as the quality upon which it was generated. And even the best evidence is often wrong. As John Ioannidis wrote, 50% of what gets published turns out to be wrong, more than 50%. The notion that it doesn't matter how good or bad, we can't evaluate the strengths and limitations of the evidence, but here's what it shows. That is a perversion of the concept of evidence-based medicine. It's the exact opposite of what this should be about. In its best iteration, is about critically appraising evidence and gives us tools to do that. That doesn't mean after you use the tools, you come up with decimal points. It means it encourages you to think. And for the most part, our conclusions should be much more full of uncertainty than certainty.
Well, let's go through and critically appraise what they said about their shift from a red recommendation to a green recommendation. And they start with some statistics about how devastating the impacts of stroke are, which, of course, we all agree, stroke can be devastating. But this could be viewed as a logical fallacy, an appeal to emotion. Just because we have a devastating condition, that must mean we need to do something.
We should do something if it works.
If it works, right.
We shouldn't do it if it doesn't work or if it causes harm.
Well, they correctly state that the initial thrombolytic trials using streptokinase were uniformly negative, and streptokinase was shown to be harmful. However, Emerson et al. Excluded these trials when they did their systematic review. But there's a Cochrane review that says there really is no difference between the clot busters when you look at the data.
Well, there are a few things to say. The first is, using my metaphor of the pennies, you can't throw out the pennies that didn't work. You just can't. That's not science. it might be that streptokinase is bad and TPA is good, but you have to prove it. You can't just say, well, every time that way that it makes it easy to prove whatever you want. You just keep repeating an experiment a million times until you get the results you want. But each time you change the penny a little bit, and then you say, oh, the other ones, they don't count because they obviously don't work. We only look at the penny that works.
Well, it must have been an Australian penny versus a Canadian penny versus an American penny. And so that was the reason. So we just need to look at the pennies that work.
So it's logically ridiculous. In addition, you'll remember that we don't have 3,000 or 6,000 patients in studies of thrombolytics for heart disease. We have 270 billion. The entire country of Italy has, you know, volunteered to be in trials, even if they didn't have a heart attack. They all were in there. And what did they show? Well, at best, if you believe the claims, and again, I don't want to get into this, but there's really good reason to be skeptical that there was any difference between any of the thrombolytics. But at best, if you believe the exaggerated, distorted claims by the manufacturer that TPA is better, it's better by 1%. If TPA is better by 1%, let's not say 1%, 2% better in stroke. You can't throw out the streptokinase studies. The difference is marginal. And then, as you point out, when you actually look at all the evidence, there isn't any difference.
Well, they also go on to promote this idea that time is brain. And that, too, has been challenged both by yourself and the Cochrane Review. But if they're including the IST3 data in Emberson, how can they exclude the evidence that is in the IST3 trial that looked at 0 to 3, 3 to 4.5 hours, and 4.5 hours beyond? And you look at that forest plot, and there isn't a time is brain data.
We found no difference in NINS, which is the whole basis for this. And by the way, just for irony, now in the world of clot retrieval instead of just clot busters, all the biggest advocates are claiming, you know what, we were wrong. Time isn't what matters. What matters is the penumbra. Time doesn't matter at all. What matters is what the MRI shows. So how could it be both?
Well, you mentioned it earlier. They claim that this modified Rankin scale is validated and reproducible without giving a reference. But there is actually evidence that the modified Rankin scale has not been shown to have good inter-rater reliability or validity. And I'll include those references in the show notes.
Yes, I made reference to that before. Absolutely.
And they also claim that the rising proportion of patients with a good outcome in the control group in the latter time windows reflects that stroke severity is lower at the later time points and more severe strokes present early. Really?
Yeah. So without going to all the details, there's huge evidence that somewhere between 15% and 30% of the patients who are diagnosed in the ED as having a stroke turn out not to have it. And that doesn't even include TIAs. That's just stroke mimics. And that's not just by emergency physicians. When the diagnosis is made by neurologists and even stroke neurologists in the one big study that did that. So, of course, that's ridiculous. But I think what they're really referring to is not that outcomes are better in the control groups later on, but rather the difference seems to be less. And this is actually fascinating. There's a famous paper by Jeff Saver which says every 15 minutes makes a difference. You know, time is so important that every 15 minutes makes a difference, and it fails to consider the real basis for that. There's a real logical misunderstanding. So what they did was they said, you know, the people who got TPA in an hour did better than the people who got it in 75 minutes, and they did better than 90 minutes, and they did better, etc., until about two and a plus hours. The difference every 15 minutes decreased over time. Early on, there was a big difference every 15 minutes. Now, imagine this. Imagine that instead of giving TPA, they gave placebo, so it could have no effect. What would you expect to see the people who got placebo at 60 minutes versus 75 minutes? Well, you'd see more good outcomes in the 60 minutes. Why? Because there are a lot of people who have a TIA and get better between 60 and 75 minutes. Between 75 and 90 minutes, there's some people who have a TIA and they get better. So 75 will be a little less better, but it'll still be better. 90 minutes, and the effect wears off at about 2 hours, which is when TIAs start to become very rare. It's exactly concordant with the data that they made claims about TPA. It had nothing to do with the TPA. It had to do that they were giving it to a bunch of TIAs early on, a few less TIAs a little later, a few less a little later, a few less. And then by 2 hours, it made no difference because there were no more TIAs.
The natural history of the disease.
The natural history of the disease, taking into account TIAs and stroke mimics. So this is all nutty. It's all nutty.
All right, well, we've been talking about the efficacy. Let's talk about the harm. And we know that harms tend to be underreported in publications. There's a bias against them. And they do say that treatment has been attempted in the absence of a collaborative team structure, and trial results have not been duplicated. And without that necessary structure, real-world treatment has either been neutral or, frankly, harmful. So what do you say about that?
Well, I think that's undoubtedly true. I mentioned before that my best guess is more negative about real world than it is in these special trials, not because the drug is worse in one circumstance than the other, but because the level of care and the certainty that you're not misusing it and giving the wrong dose, giving it to the wrong person, et cetera. There are a lot of things that make it look better when you're doing it in a trial, and not to mention the Hawthorne effect. Just by studying something, you always get better results than you would otherwise. So if they were correct, which I think they're completely incorrect, by saying that in the trials it is better. And by the way, they don't say how much better, and is that better neutralized by harm, cost, et cetera, harm to other people because we're spending all of our efforts on stroke and we're not taking care of the others. Every study that's looked at, when you start having a trauma unit, your heart attack patients do worse. When you have a diabetes unit, your stroke patients do worse. You know, we can't pay perfect attention to everything. But even aside from that, if we actually believe what they're claiming, which is that under the perfect circumstances of a study, it does well. Oh, but it hasn't been replicated in the real world. In the real world, it doesn't do better. In fact, it does worse. On what ethical basis could you then say, well, but do it in the real world, but do it well. Don't do it poorly like all of your neighbors do it. What does that mean? Either it means you've got to create a new elaborate system to make everybody do it like in a study, which, by the way, is impossible because studies, there is a Hawthorne effect. Studies do better than outside of studies, regardless of how careful you are. But even aside from that, if it were true that we could all act just like the studies, how, at what cost? At what harm? At what harm to other patients? At what harm to the system? At what harm to lost opportunity cost? And by the way, just wishing it so, wouldn't you have to prove that it was so? And if you didn't spend all that time, money, et cetera, building an elaborate other system and forgetting about all the other patients, if you didn't do it and you just recommended doing it in the real world because in the studies it did well, you would be condemning people to bad outcomes. How can they make the say, oh, it doesn't work as well. In fact, it doesn't work. In fact, it could be harmful. In fact, it does increase deaths in the real world, but do it. This is stunning.
The only clear signal that I can see in the thrombolytic literature is the increased risk for bleeding. That's the one signal that gets through. There's a lot of other noise talking about efficacy, but the one clear signal is the increase in bleed.
And mortality is pretty clearly increased. And when you look at the, you know, they mentioned the Cleveland study, which was the first of the studies which looked at everybody who got it in Cleveland and said, oh my God, the outcomes are terrible. That's not the only one. There are a half dozen studies, including way bigger than in Cleveland, which look at real world use not sponsored by the manufacturer. There's a bunch of what's so-called effectiveness studies, which means in the real world, there's a bunch that are sponsored by the manufacturer that claim, oh, we gave it and it came out great. But there's also a bunch which were not sponsored by the manufacturer and which didn't cherry pick and only selectively look at certain patients, but looked at every patient who got it in Cleveland or every patient who got it in the state of Connecticut or every patient who got it in the state of Michigan or every patient who got it in the entire United States with 100,000 people, and every one of those says, oh my God, the results are terrible. Bleeding is worse. Death is worse. Outcomes, neurologic outcomes are worse. Everything is worse. So it's not just one study of 80 patients which said you can't do it in the real world. It's huge evidence that in the real world, this is harmful. And yet they say, well, we believe it worked in the perfect studies. We wrongly believe it worked in the perfect studies. Therefore, go out and do it, guys. Green light.
Green light, but make sure you do it well.
But do it well. Don't do it like all the other people. All of you do it well.
You mentioned the idea of industry funding, and that's one of the things I wanted to touch on, because they do mention in their caveats that four of the trials were exclusively funded by industry and five were publicly funded. Can you comment on the impact that industry funding can have on trials in general?
Sure. You don't need me to tell you that there's lots of evidence that industry funding of both trials and editorials, individuals, leads to tremendous overemphasis of positive results and underemphasis of negative results. The results look better. They're interpreted as better. They're overinterpreted as better. The editorials are more positive than they should be. Every place where it has been evaluated, and there are many, in Emma, we did hundreds of articles looking at the influence of industry. Every single one of them shows that industry studies are purport to be far more positive than non-industry studies, that they not only the studies themselves, but the methods, the analysis of the studies is way over the top compared to non-industry studies, that editorials by people who take money are enormously biased, et cetera, et cetera. If we're honest with ourselves, every one of us has to know in our hearts that this is true, that when somebody's really nice to you, and particularly when they're nice to you, giving you money, and in this case, lots of money, but it doesn't have to be lots of money. They're just nice to you. This is a tremendously well-known psychological phenomenon. Unconsciously, we are biased. We can't help it. And so in my career, I refused ever to take industry money. And people said to me, "You're being holier than thou. Who do you think you are? You're holier than thou." And I always said, "No, it's the exact opposite. If I were holier than thou, I'd be like a lot of the people who take industry money and say, oh yeah, other people are biased, but I'm not. I won't be biased. I know I would be biased." So the only solution is not to take the money.
Well, one of the other things that I'm seeing happen is not only the individual authors who have financial conflicts of interest or funding of the studies, but we're creating a stroke system, and jobs now depend on this new system of bypassing hospitals, using extra resources at the receiving hospitals. So people's jobs are on the line when they defend the efficacy of thrombolysis for acute ischemic stroke.
Absolutely. But, you know, it's sort of interesting that line is often used to defend we should keep doing what we're doing even if it's not good. So in the United States, we have this very broken healthcare system and this huge insurance industry that takes 20% or 25 or 30% of all healthcare dollars that should be going to patients, goes to the industry and distorts healthcare enormously. And people say, yeah, but if you got rid of it, think of all the jobs that would be lost. You can't do that. And the same with foreign wars that shouldn't be fought, and all sorts of things where we're sending money that where some of us think we're spending it in a very bad way, and others say, well, you might be right, it's bad, but we, you know, think of all the jobs. I've never heard anybody say, you know, we shouldn't stop illegal street drugs because so many people's lives, industry depends on it. There's so many people out there selling drugs on the street, and they wouldn't have a job if we cracked down.
Well, the last point is I wanted to talk about in this section was just about intellectual conflicts of interest, because it's one thing to be able to quantify the exchange of dollars or the exchange of gifts or trips to Hawaii, but there's also people now intellectually invested into this issue because many careers are tied to thrombolytics for acute ischemic stroke.
Yeah, I think you have to be really careful. You know, people would say that I can't be objective because I've already said what I think about this, and people think they know what I say, and I wouldn't ever be able to back down. Except that there is some truth to the notion that there are many ways in which we can be biased, even unconsciously. But I think this is used not as a way to shed light on other potential problems, but rather to diminish concerns about financial conflicts of interest. There is overwhelming evidence that financial conflicts of interest are far more important than all the others that put together, publication interests, and, you know, you want your career and you've already made a statement. Yes, we should be careful. We should all of us try to be humble and try to be able to backstep if we are proven wrong, even though it might be difficult, even though we might be biased. But they pale in comparison to financial conflicts of interest, where the evidence is so overwhelmingly clear. So this is, I think, mostly used as a red herring. Not to say there isn't some truth to it, but I think it's a red herring to get us to say, well, why should you care about financial conflict interest when everybody has a conflict?
All right, well, I'm going to get to some of the other arguments. One of the other arguments has been, this has been going on for 24 years since NINS was published. That ship has sailed, the horse is out of the barn, the genie's out of the bottle, you'll never put that back in. And we shouldn't be having this debate. Let's move on to the embolectomies. And thrombolysis is a settled issue.
I'm not sure exactly what to say. There are many things that we've done in medicine for long, long periods that were wrong. And eventually we stopped doing them. And if we believe that this is not a good idea, it shouldn't matter that it's been 2 years, 12 years, 37 years. That isn't to say that this is entirely untrue. It is true that, unfortunately, although surveys of emergency physicians make it clear that skepticism is rampant and that the large majority of emergency physicians remain skeptical, it's becoming more used because, not because people have changed their mind, but because they're sort of giving in. You know, how long can you hold out? And there's a lot of money and influence, and you get graded, and you know, your hospital says we need to be a stroke center because that makes us money, and therefore you have to play along. And I know a lot of people who say, I don't want to do it, but you know what? They send the neurologist down, and then I wash my hands of it. And I understand that. I will mention to you, you remember the steroids for spinal cord injury, which was presented to physicians in the United States essentially as a mandate. We all got a personal letter from the Surgeon General the day that the article was published in the New England Journal telling us about this important new thing and that we had to know about it and therefore obviously had to do it. It was as close to a standard of care as anything I've ever heard. And, you know, people worry about lawsuits. And if you want to have a lawsuit, what you need, you know, there's four things you're supposed to have, but none of those really matter. What you really need is a bad outcome and somebody who's upset and damages, because the lawyer won't be interested if there aren't damages. Spinal cord injury is the best at all of those things, because these are young people who are going to be alive but debilitated for some period of time, huge costs. The outcome is almost always bad once they have a certain initial injury. Here was a treatment that many of us knew wasn't good, but if you didn't give it, you had the perfect storm for a lawsuit, terrible damages and a bad outcome. And you're sort of like raising your hand, I'd like to be one of those sued because I didn't follow the standard of care that my own Surgeon General told me to do. There are pressures on us to do things that we don't think are right. Now, I don't claim it's easy. That I mentioned that as an example of where it would be really hard. Well, guess what? 20, 25 years it took for people to say, wait a second, that's wrong. We shouldn't do it. Stop doing it. It's harmful. It's not beneficial. So just to sum up, I think there is truth to the fact that this is established in many communities and many people are reluctantly doing it. I don't think we should. I think there are ways to solve this problem for you personally as an emergency physician by giving informed consent or informed refusal to your patients. Because in my experience, a lot of them, when they hear that this is controversial and that it increases bleeding into the brain and probably deaths, even when they're then told by an advocate that it's the best thing since sliced bread, many of them refuse. So I think you can at least say, you know, it's my patient. I can't just wash my hands of it. And I'm going to talk to the patient about it and let them decide. But whatever you choose to do, you know, there are some battles that you lose. That doesn't mean you shouldn't keep fighting them.
I think that's great advice. Just because it's difficult or it's hard, medicine is difficult and hard. We didn't go into it because it was easy, and we should still keep advocating for our patients because it starts with patient care and it ends with patient care. That's why we're physicians. Nobody went into medical school interviews and said, oh, I'm here for the money.
Nor did they go into it to say, what I'm interested in doing is getting skill at reading directives that tell me what to do. Here's what you do if it's sepsis. Here's what you do if it's stroke. Here's what you do if the lactate is Z. We didn't sign up for this, nor were we chosen because of our capacity to be automatons. The whole notion of evidence-based medicine as green lights and red lights, and well, don't bother with evaluating the evidence, just do what you're told, strikes me as the opposite of what most of us value and privilege about being physicians.
Well, one of the things I always say about this issue is that the burden of proof is on those making the positive claim. And in the case of thrombolysis for stroke, I don't think that burden of proof of net benefit has been demonstrated. And so I remain skeptical, and I need to be demonstrated that there is a benefit and it outweighs that potential harm. Where do you think we should go from here, though? What advice would you give? What should we do?
We have a big ocean liner that we're trying to move. And I don't mean just TPA for stroke. I mean medicine. I mean medicine as a business, a profit-driven business in the United States in particular, but even in your country, where there are pressures on us to do things that are not always right. I mean issues of where you're told that in sepsis you must do A, B, C, and D, even though you read it and you say that's crazy. There are a lot of things like this. And one of the things that strikes me, Ken, is that we often see ourselves as helpless. We say, oh my God, this is crazy, but what am I going to do about it? And I have to say that I try to remind physicians that when they ask the public about what do you think about various job categories, we're not held in the same esteem as nurses, but we're held in pretty high esteem. And that's even in general. In specific, we're held in even much higher esteem. Everybody likes their doctor. And why do I say that? Because it reminds me that we're not powerless. We're not helpless. We are helpless as individuals. If we just say, I refuse to do it, and we don't go any further than that, it will be done. You can't fight City Hall by yourself. But I think we have a tremendous ability to get together, talk to each other, and demand changes for the better. EHR, for me, is a great example of this. EHR is something that, obviously, computers could be useful, but I don't think most of my colleagues think they're useful. I think mostly we hate them. The reasons for that are obvious. They're not designed to do what you and I want from them. They're designed to do something entirely different. In the U.S., it's to maximize billing. I'm not sure about in Canada, but I assume it's fairly similar. You can't just say, I'm not going to write in the EHR, but if a bunch of doctors got together and demanded change and said, we're not going to comply, we're not going to do this, would have tremendous impact. We can't continue to think of ourselves as helpless. And we're not going to win every battle, and some things we're going to lose. But I believe I've always tried to act as though what I believe matters and that I should try to do the right thing, and I should try to get other people to think about things that we're being told to do that I have trouble with. And I think we all need to start thinking that way.
Well, thank you very much, Jerry, for coming back on the SGEM and again demonstrating why you are a legend of emergency medicine.
You're way too kind, Ken.
Well, you've taught me so much. But I do invite my friend, Dr. Eddie Lang, or any of his co-authors, or anyone else who feels really strongly and differently about this to contact me. I'm happy to have a conversation on future episodes. But Jerry, the SGEM tagline was a variation of something I have heard you say many times, and it would be a real honor if you would read the tagline.
Sure. So I'm going to have to remember it off the top of my head. Don't believe what you hear. Be skeptical, even if you heard it from me. Something like that.
So remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. No, it's true.